She appeared to be the picture-perfect schoolteacher. Smart, composed, the kind of woman parents trusted with their children. But beneath the polished surface of Carolyn Wormus's life lay a dark undercurrent of obsession and jealousy. In January 1989, in the quiet suburb of Greenboro, New York, 40-year-old mother Betty Jean Solomon was found shot 9 times in her living room, a violent end to a marriage that had already been fractured by betrayal. The prime suspect wasn't a stranger. It was Carolyn, Helen's younger co-worker, and the woman having a secret affair with Betty's husband, Paul Solomon. Wealthy, ambitious, and desperate, Wormus stood trial twice, once ending in a hung jury, the second sealing her fate with the emergence of a single bloody glove. Convicted in May 1992, she faced 25 years to life behind bars, maintaining her innocence at every turn. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Web of Secrets. The winter sky hung low over Greenburg, New York, on the night of January 15th, 1989. Snow crusted the sidewalks. Porch lights flickered behind curtains, illuminating quiet suburban homes that all seemed to whisper the same lie. Nothing bad ever happens here. At 11:42 p.m., Officer Michael Devine stepped through the open front door of 205 North Broadway. What he found was not a burglary gone wrong or a random act of violence. It was a scene soaked in intention. On the floor lay 40-year-old Betty Jean Solomon, face down, riddled with 9 gunshots. Her blood was pooled beside a toppled side table. A family photo had shattered in the corner. The TV still murmured a late-night rerun in the background, untouched. There was no forced entry, no valuables taken, no sign of struggle beyond the gunfire. Whoever killed her hadn't been in a rush. They came to end a life, not to steal one. Her husband, Paul Solomon, had made the call. He told police he'd just returned from a night out. His voice trembled, but not with shock, at least not the kind that convinces cops anymore. Detectives noticed the oddities immediately. Paul claimed to have spent the evening with a woman named Really Do It. She answered selectively, only to those who weren't looking for a soundbite. One letter stood out. It came from a law student named Jonah Reynolds. In his final year at NYU, he had taken a criminal justice seminar that used Carolyn's trial as a case study. He didn't believe she was innocent, not yet. But he saw holes, patterns that didn't add up. He quoted transcripts, challenged ballistic assumptions, raised questions about the chain of custody for the glove. But what really caught Carolyn's eye was this line. If you were framed, you weren't the only victim. Justice was too. They exchanged dozens of letters. Jonah visited the prison twice. He told her about an emerging field of DNA testing, far more sensitive than what had been used in 1992. He believed it could retest the glove. But Carolyn had been down this road before. Requests had been denied. Appeals exhausted. Her case was considered closed, sealed in headlines and judgment. Don't chase ghosts, she wrote once. Jonah replied, they don't stay ghosts, if we can name them. In 2017, nearly 28 years after the murder, Carolyn filed for DNA testing on the glove and the bullets. Jonah helped prepare the petition. She didn't expect it to go through. Most prisoners don't. But the world had changed. A wave of wrongful conviction cases was sweeping the nation. New York courts were more open to revisiting old evidence. The judge approved the motion. It was the first ray of hope she'd seen in years. but it came with a risk. What if the glove matched her? What if newer tests confirmed what the old ones couldn't? Still, she signed the forms. "I'd rather know than rot in doubt," she told Jonah during a phone call. "Even if it proves I'm the monster they think I am." The results took 8 months. In that time, Carolyn began writing a memoir, part legal record, part emotional reckoning. She called it A Shadow of the Truth. The first line read, "I fell in love with the wrong man. Everything after that was punishment." When the test results finally came back, she was called into the warden's office. A plainclothes official from the district attorney's office sat at the table. Jonah was patched in on speakerphone. The results were inconclusive. The DNA in the glove lining could not be definitively matched to Carolyn or to anyone. It was too degraded. The lab found multiple DNA profiles, none strong enough to confirm or eliminate her. The bullets had no usable DNA at all. It wasn't a win, but it wasn't a loss. It was enough to raise eyebrows again. The press caught wind of it. Suddenly, her name was back in the news. Warman seeks new trial. DNA evidence may clear convicted killer. Talk shows rehashed the story. Experts debated. Jonah submitted a new motion for post-conviction relief based on modern standards of evidence. Carolyn, now in her mid-50s, waited quietly in her cell. Older, wiser, but still burning with the same stubborn fire. And in the silence of her small, gray world, she whispered one line to herself every night. "If they give me one more chance, I'll tell the truth. All of it." Chapter 5. The truth she never told. They always asked her the same question. "Did you do it?" For decades, Carolyn gave the same answer. "No." But that wasn't the whole truth. The truth, the actual truth, was messier than guilt or innocence. And the part no one ever asked, not really, was, "What did you let happen?" It started with a gun. She didn't own one. Never had. But she knew where Paul kept his. In the top drawer of his bedroom dresser, tucked beneath folded t-shirts inside a zippered leather case. She'd seen it once when he was changing shirts before dinner. "Why do you have this?" she'd asked, half joking. "Because I'm a man," he said, smiling. He told her it wasn't loaded, but she knew it was. They'd been seeing each other for almost 2 years. Paul had promised everything. A shared apartment, a summer in Italy, a quiet wedding somewhere small. He told her his marriage was just a formality. He told her Betty Jean was cold, controlling, that she didn't love him anymore. Carolyn believed him. But as the months dragged on, the promises faded. The romantic gestures stopped. And then came the silence, the sudden cancellations, the nights where he didn't return her calls. She could feel herself slipping, losing control. Not just of him, but of herself. One night, in a moment she would later replay endlessly, she asked, "Are you still sleeping with her?" Paul didn't answer. That silence felt worse than a yes. Something broke inside her. But she didn't kill Betty, Jean. Not directly. What she did was plant a seed. She remembered the night like a movie scene. It was snowing lightly. Paul had picked her up in his car, driving her to a deserted parking lot just off the highway. They sat in the dark, heater on, windows fogging. Carolyn leaned in, kissed him softly, and whispered, "You know, there's only one way we'll ever be free." He pulled back. "What are you saying?" "You're miserable. I'm miserable. She'll never let you go." She didn't say it again. She didn't need to. "And Paul?" He didn't answer. He just stared straight ahead, drumming his fingers on the steering wheel. That was a week before Betty Jean died. After the murder, Paul told Carolyn to say nothing, to deny everything. He said the police would try to twist their relationship, to make it look like she had motive. He begged her to stick to their alibi. "I love you," he said. "Trust me." So she did. She told the police they were together the entire evening. She stuck to the story, even when the pressure built, even when the evidence began to stack against her. And then, the glove. Carolyn didn't recognize it, didn't own one like it. But she knew it hadn't been in her trunk before. Someone had put it there. She didn't want to believe Paul could do that. But deep down, a cold realization began to take shape. He was letting her take the fall. He'd set the board, moved the pieces. And now he was walking away clean. The second trial confirmed it. His immunity, his distance, his carefully rehearsed sorrow on the stand. He was done with her. In prison, that betrayal fermented. For years, she tried to convince herself she had been naive, misled. But as she sat in that cell day after day, what haunted her wasn't just the lie. It was the opportunity she'd given him. She hadn't pulled the trigger, but she hadn't stopped him either. And maybe in that quiet space between heartbreak and hatred, she had wanted it to happen. So when Jonah asked years later if she'd ever tell her full story, she paused. "No one wants the truth," she said. "They want guilt or innocence, a headline, something easy. But what if the truth is the only thing that can set you free?" he asked. She shook her head. "There's no freedom left for me, just clarity." So she wrote it down, all of it, the affair, the silence, the moments she looked away when she should have spoken up. She confessed, not to the murder, but to the complicity, the emotional cowardice, the way she let herself be used, and how she justified it in the name of love. The manuscript she gave Jonah was raw, unedited, angry. It didn't ask for sympathy. It didn't cry innocence. It simply said, "Sometimes you don't need to hold the weapon to be guilty. Sometimes all it takes is silence." Jonah asked if he could publish it. She said no, not yet. She wasn't ready to be redefined, not as a victim, not as a villain, just as someone who finally stopped lying. But fate, it seemed, wasn't finished with her. 6 months later, a new piece of evidence emerged. Jonah had quietly hired a private investigator to revisit the night of the murder. One name kept surfacing, a co-worker of Paul's from a former school district, a woman he had once been involved with, someone who, according to a retired bartender in Yonkers, was seen arguing with Paul outside the same lounge on the night of the murder. It was a long shot, but enough to cast more doubt. Jonah filed a motion to reopen the case, not for a retrial, but for reconsideration of sentence based on mitigated culpability. In plain terms, Carolyn didn't kill, but she didn't stop it either. Now the court had to decide, was that still murder? Chapter 6, A Second Chance, or a Final Sentence. In the spring of her 32nd year behind bars, Carolyn Warman stood in front of a parole board for the first time. She wore a simple gray suit issued by the prison vocational program. Her hair, now streaked with silver, was pulled into a low bun. Her face had softened with age, but her eyes still held that same quiet defiance that once stunned a courtroom decades earlier. Three board members sat before her, each with a thick file stamped, State v. Warman. For hours, they reviewed every detail. Her behavior in prison, her educational work, her attempts at rehabilitation. Then they asked the question she had been preparing for since her first night in that cold cell. "Do you accept full responsibility for the murder of Betty Jean Solomon?" Carolyn paused. In another lifetime, she might have said no. Outright, clean, defiant. But now, after all these years, she understood that guilt wasn't always a bullet. Sometimes it was silence. Sometimes it was what you allowed. "I didn't pull the trigger," she said, "but I helped set the stage. I looked away from what I didn't want to believe. I let love blind me to what he was capable of. I lied to protect him. That lie cost a woman her life. I will carry that for the rest of mine." The room went still. The board scribbled notes, exchanged glances, and closed her file. "We'll notify you of our decision within 60 days. Carolyn exhaled slowly. She returned to her unit in silence. No celebration, no false hope. Just the same metal doors, the same 6-kneen concrete box. But that night, she let herself imagine it. A walk through Central Park. Coffee with Jonah at a real cafe. Maybe even writing again. Not as the woman they accused her of being, but as the one she finally became. And meanwhile, outside prison walls. Jonah Reynolds sat at a diner in Manhattan with a battered leather notebook in front of him. Across from him was reporter Natalie Vega from The Ledger. She had covered the Warman case in the early 90s as a junior field reporter, then dropped it when the case went cold. But now, she was back. The new lead Jonah had uncovered was making quiet waves through legal circles. That former co-worker of Paul's, the woman seen with him the night of the murder, had never been interviewed by police. And now she was missing. Jonah's investigator had tracked her to a small town in Florida under a married name. Her husband had filed a missing person report 3 years earlier. Vanished without a trace. Natalie tapped her pen against the table. "Are you saying there could have been another woman? A second affair?" "I'm saying Paul had a pattern, and we only ever focused on one." "Do you think he set Carolyn up?" Jonah looked out of the window, watching the rush of traffic and people who had never heard the name Carolyn Warman. "I think she let herself be used. I think he walked away clean. And I think, if we keep digging, we'll find out exactly how far he was willing to go." Back in Bedford Hills, a white envelope slid under Carolyn's door one morning. Inside was a single sentence typed on standard court letterhead, "Parole granted." Her knees buckled. It wasn't freedom. Not yet. It was supervised release, strict conditions, and lifelong monitoring. But it was movement. It was air. It was the first door opening after decades in a hallway of dead ends. She packed what little she had. 2 books. A photo of her mother. A worn journal filled with poems she never shared. On the day she left Bedford Hills, she didn't look back. Jonah met her outside the gate, holding a simple bouquet of white tulips. "Welcome back," he said. They didn't hug, not yet. But they stood close. Close enough that she could finally feel what life beyond steel felt like. They drove straight to a safe house upstate. Media had already caught wind of her release. Paparazzi circled like vultures. But Carolyn wasn't interested in headlines. She sat on the porch with a cup of tea and watched the wind roll through the trees. "I thought it would feel different," she said. "Better?" "No, just different." "You've still got a trial in the court of public opinion," Jonah reminded her. "They're already calling it a miscarriage of justice." She nodded. "Let them." He opened his bag and pulled out the file. "I think we have enough to reopen the case, if we push hard." She hesitated. For a long time, revenge had been the fuel that kept her going. But now she wanted something else. Not a retrial, not a confession, just the truth. and peace. Chapter 7. Truth Buried But Breathing. For the first time in over 30 years, Carolyn Warman slept with the lights off. There was no clanging metal at midnight, no guard shouting roll call. Just the low hum of wind outside her cabin window and the whisper of old trees swaying against the dusk. Freedom hadn't been what she expected. It was quiet, unforgiving. Every coffee tasted different. Every face on the street looked like someone she'd never know. She still flinched at sudden noises, still measured her words like they were evidence in a courtroom. But she was here, breathing. And the truth? It had followed her out of Bedford Hills like a shadow. Jonah pressed for action. He believed there was enough for a reinvestigation into Paul Solomon, not as a co-conspirator, as the primary. But Carolyn wasn't sure she wanted to go back until the letter came. It was postmarked from upstate New York. No return address. Inside, a single torn photo. Betty Jean Solomon, smiling, standing beside Paul. But the back of the photo told the story. You were never the only one. She wasn't either. There was no signature, just an old date in smudged ink. 1986, 3 years before the murder. It was a photo Carolyn had never seen. She stared at it for hours, and then she made her decision. 1 month later, a new motion was filed. This time, not to overturn her conviction, but to launch a formal investigation into Paul Solomon. Jonah drafted the brief, tying in witness statements from decades ago, financial records showing life insurance payouts, and new information from a whistleblower, a former colleague of Paul's who admitted he overheard Solomon threatening Betty Jean in the months before her death. I'll make you disappear before I give up half my life to you, he'd said during a late-night staff meeting in 1988. The affidavit was signed, notarized, submitted. It didn't prove guilt, but it reopened a door. The DA's office responded cautiously. The case had long been closed. The lead detective had retired. Most of the records were boxed and stored in dust-coated archives, but they agreed to review. For Carolyn, that was enough. Months passed. The headlines returned, briefly. Ex-schoolteacher may have been framed. Fatal attraction case re-examined. The public, as fickle as ever, turned the story into something new. A podcast. A book deal. A dramatized streaming series pitched by an independent filmmaker. But Carolyn didn't care anymore. She moved to a quiet town near the Catskills, changed her name, adopted a rescue dog, and began writing a memoir, not for profit. For Truth, its working title, The Things I Didn't Say in Court, she wrote every day. Sometimes just a sentence, other days 10 pages. She wrote about the lies she told, the silence she kept, the way trauma buries itself not in memory, but in muscle. She wrote about Betty Jean, not as a rival, but as a woman betrayed by the same man. And she wrote about Paul, how he walked free, how he built a new life, remarried, retired, vanished from public view, until the letter arrived. This one wasn't anonymous. It came from Jonah, delivered in person. He sat across from Carolyn, expression unreadable. They found something, he said. She didn't move, just waited. The gun. It turned up in a pawn shop in Syracuse. Registered to Paul's name. Sold in 92. Her breath caught. Ballistics confirmed the match. It was the weapon that killed Betty Jean Solomon. Chain of custody would be tough to prove in court. The case was old. The shop owner had died years earlier. But still, there it was. The final piece. Jonah looked at her. It's not justice, but it's something. Carolyn smiled, but it didn't reach her eyes. It's not for me anymore, she said. It's for her. She folded the photo, placed it in the back of her journal, and closed the cover. 1 year later, the state issued a rare statement. Based on new forensic evidence and corroborating testimony, the conviction of Carolyn Warman is under official review for possible exoneration. It didn't clear her. Not yet. But the world was finally listening. Betty Jean's daughter, now grown, reached out. No cameras, no statements. Just a handwritten note. "I don't know if you did it, but I know my father wasn't who I thought he was. And I'm sorry." Carolyn cried for the first time in years. Not because of guilt, not because of freedom, but because someone finally believed her silence had a story too. Carolyn Warman, a fellow schoolteacher, not just a colleague, but a lover. He admitted the affair within the first 20 minutes of questioning. Carolyn Warman was everything Betty John wasn't. Young, blonde, cultured, 28 and ambitious, she came from money. Her father was a wealthy insurance executive with deep pockets and political friends. She taught at Greenville Elementary, where Paul worked. And though she was a teacher by title, she moved through life like she had something to prove or something to win. Police traced a phone call made from Carolyn's apartment that afternoon. It had been placed to a sporting goods shop in New Jersey, Ray's Sport House, famous locally for selling guns and ammunition. A purchase had been made around 3:01 p.m. A box of 25 caliber rounds, the same type used in Betty John's murder. The name on the receipt didn't match Carolyn's, but the timing couldn't be ignored. Paul insisted Carolyn couldn't have done it. They'd met up later that night, had drinks at a bar in Yonkers, then had sex in the parking lot of a Holiday Inn. Classy, right? His alibi placed her with him between 9 and 11:30 p.m., just before he discovered his wife's body. The problem? The murder had occurred around 9:20 p.m., give or take 15 minutes. Meaning, if Carolyn had left earlier, or if Paul was lying, the window of opportunity still existed. Then came the witness. A private investigator by the name of Vince Paterno came forward, saying Carolyn had once hired him under a false name. She asked him to track Paul's wife. Wanted to know her routines, where she shopped, if she was ever alone. Carolyn had paid in cash, and when he grew suspicious, she offered him more money and even tried seducing him. That changed everything. Suddenly, Carolyn wasn't just the scorned other woman. She became the woman who watched, who tracked, who planned. But even then, the case wasn't airtight. The murder weapon was never found. No prints, no DNA. Just circumstantial connections, subtle behaviors, and a glaring motive. Carolyn denied everything. She told detectives that Paul had been stringing her along for years, that he made promises he never kept, said he was going to leave his wife, but never did, that he manipulated her with guilt and attention, retreating just enough to keep her begging for more. She admitted jealousy. She admitted rage. But murder? No. Yet everyone had a story about her. One coworker recalled her temper when Paul didn't show up to school events. Another remembered the time she sent flowers to his classroom while his wife was sitting in the front row. There were rumors that Carolyn had once followed the couple on vacation, confronting Paul on the beach in Puerto Rico, crying hysterically in front of his children. Was it love, or was it obsession? The community wasn't sure. But the media had already decided. They branded her the fatal attraction killer, a beautiful blonde teacher who gunned down her lover's wife in a fit of jealous rage. The story sold itself. Still, prosecutors weren't certain they could win. So they leaned into what they had, Carolyn's behavior, her purchases, her obsession, and her lack of a solid alibi. Meanwhile, her defense painted her as the scapegoat of a failed marriage. They hinted that Paul, not Carolyn, had the most to gain, that he wanted to be with her, without the baggage of a divorce. And then, there was the glove. Months into the investigation, a single leather glove was found in the trunk of Carolyn's car, stained faintly with blood. It matched the kind police believed the killer wore. The blood was old, degraded, but the symbolism was potent. A single glove, a hidden detail, a whispered echo of guilt. When Carolyn Warman was arrested in February 1990, she didn't cry. She didn't scream. She asked one question. Is Paul here? And that was the first chapter in a story that would twist through two trials, a media circus, and a legacy so sensational it would inspire not one, but two TV movies. But beneath the headlines and the scandal, one question would always remain. Did Carolyn kill out of love? Or was she simply the most convenient villain in a crime of marital convenience? Chapter 2. The First Trial. The courtroom was packed. From the very first day of proceedings, it felt less like a murder trial and more like theater. Journalists from every major paper crowded the benches, their notepads twitching at every raised eyebrow and whispered objection. Cameras weren't allowed inside, but that didn't stop them from lining the courthouse steps outside, waiting for a glimpse of the schoolteacher-turned-siren as she stepped from the back of the squad car in designer coats and perfect hair. Carolyn Warman, a woman who, by all accounts, should have been grading spelling tests or planning school assemblies. Instead, she stood trial for murder, accused of gunning down the wife of her secret lover. The prosecution wasted no time. In opening statements, they painted Carolyn as a woman fueled by obsession. They called her entitled, unhinged, and ultimately dangerous. A woman who couldn't accept rejection and who believed that if she couldn't have Paul Solomon, no one could. They outlined a motive rooted in humiliation. Carolyn had sacrificed her dignity, her career, and possibly her sanity for a man who made empty promises. She waited for him to leave his wife. He didn't. And when the illusion shattered, so did her restraint. Then came the physical evidence, or lack of it. There was no murder weapon, no clear fingerprints. The only tangible item tying her to the scene was the glove, found months after the murder, buried in the spare tire well of her car. Its presence raised questions. If she was innocent, how did it get there? But if she was guilty, why hide just one glove? And so sloppily. The prosecution called the glove a souvenir of guilt. But it was circumstantial, and the defense knew it. Carolyn's attorney, a sharp, seasoned criminal defender named Wallace Brannigan, took a different approach. He didn't try to claim Carolyn was perfect. He leaned into her flaws, into her heartbreak. She was in love, Brannigan said in his opening remarks. She was manipulated. She believed him. That doesn't make her a murderer. He went on to suggest that Paul Solomon had more motive than anyone in the room. If Betty Jean found out about the affair and threatened divorce, he would have lost custody of his daughter and half of his finances. Paul stood to gain the most from Betty Jean's death. But the state had a witness. Paul Solomon himself. Clean-cut and calm, Paul took the stand and recounted how his marriage had been falling apart. He spoke of Carolyn with a kind of detached sorrow. He called the affair a mistake, one he had tried to end many times. She wanted more than I could give her, he said. He described her temper, her unpredictability, how she showed up at his house late at night, how she once sent a letter to his wife, signed anonymously, urging Betty Jean to ask your husband where he was Thursday night. The jury leaned in. Then came the most damning moment, the phone call. A record of a call from Carolyn's apartment to the gun shop in New Jersey on the afternoon of the murder. Someone bought .25 caliber bullets shortly after that call. The bullets used to kill Betty Jean. Carolyn admitted the call was hers, but said she was buying ammunition for a friend who liked to target shoot. No name, no receipt, just her word. Brannigan turned the narrative on its head during cross-examination. He asked why Paul hadn't called 911 the moment he walked into his home and found his wife's body. Why, instead, did he walk through the blood-soaked living room and use the house phone in the kitchen, touching the same surfaces a killer might have? He asked why Paul didn't try to revive her, why he waited. Paul stumbled. "I panicked." Brannigan dug deeper. "Or you knew she was beyond saving, because you were the one who killed her?" Objection. Sustained. But the seed had been planted. The defense team also brought in witnesses who testified that Carolyn was seen at the Yonkers bar that night, around 9:30 p.m. That she had been with Paul. That she didn't seem distraught or in a rush. The timeline became a fog of maybe and maybe not. Then came the PI. Vincent Paterno was a curveball. A former cop turned private investigator, he testified that Carolyn had once hired him to follow Paul's wife, long before the murder. She wanted to know where Betty Jean went during the day, who she talked to. At one point, Paterno claimed, Carolyn offered to trade cash or comfort for quicker results. The courtroom buzzed. Carolyn sat stone-faced. She didn't blink. In closing arguments, the prosecution relied heavily on emotion. They replayed 911 audio. They showed family photos of Betty Jean smiling at birthday parties, unaware that her marriage was dissolving beneath her. They urged the jury to look beyond the missing gun, to see the psychological profile. She didn't snap. She simmered, the prosecutor said. And on January 15th, she boiled over. But Brannigan hit back with doubt. No weapon? No prints? No witnesses who saw her near the home? He reminded them that Paul had immunity. He couldn't be prosecuted, even if he had pulled the trigger. Convenient, isn't it? He asked. The man who had everything to gain walks free. And the woman who was foolish enough to fall for him sits in chains. The jury deliberated for nearly a week. When they returned, they were split. 9-3, three jurors refused to convict. They said there was too much gray, too many unanswered questions. The trial ended in a hung jury. A mistrial was declared. Carolyn was taken back to her cell. Paul returned to teaching. The media exploded with headlines about the unresolved case. And the public? Divided. Some believed Carolyn had gotten away with murder. Others believed she was a pawn, set up to take the fall for a man who never stopped lying. But the state wasn't done. 3 months later, the district attorney filed to retry the case. This time, they said, they had new evidence. Something no one had seen the first time around. A leather glove, one that now tested positive for Betty Jean's blood. The second trial would be even more brutal than the first, and this time there would be no hung jury. Chapter 3. Blood on Leather. The second trial began under heavier security, tighter press access, and far greater public scrutiny. The first trial had left too many questions unanswered. This time, the prosecution promised clarity, finality. And they had a new ace, a single glove. It had been overlooked, dismissed, almost forgotten. But months after the mistrial, investigators revisited the evidence seized from Carolyn Warman's silver sedan. Tucked deep inside the spare tire compartment was a leather glove, dark brown, slightly worn, and lined with faint traces of dried blood. Initial tests had been inconclusive, but technology had evolved, and with the state now more determined than ever, the glove was tested again. This time, it yielded a partial blood match. The blood, prosecutors claimed, belonged to Betty Jean Solomon. Carolyn's defense team argued contamination. They questioned the chain of custody, the condition of the trunk, the validity of partial DNA profiles. But the timing couldn't be dismissed. The glove was found in her car, long after she claimed never to have been near the crime scene. This time, the prosecution didn't waste words. They rebuilt their entire case around motive, obsession, and now, blood. Their argument was simple. The woman who left that glove didn't just want a man. She wanted a life that wasn't hers. And when that dream dissolved, so did her restraint. Witnesses were called back, most of them the same faces from the first trial. Paul Solomon, co-workers from Greenville Elementary, the private investigator, and forensic experts. But this time, the narrative was tighter, cleaner, more brutal. Paul recounted the affair again, but with more distance, more detachment. If the first trial showed him as conflicted, the second painted him as cold. He described Carolyn's intensity as emotional suffocation. Recalled how she followed him home, how she left notes inside his briefcase, how she threatened to tell his wife if he didn't commit. The prosecution used Paul to underscore one thing. Carolyn had motive, and her reaction to being rejected was not sadness. It was rage. They brought up Carolyn's diary, confiscated from her apartment. One entry read, "She stands in the way of everything I want. If she vanished tomorrow, he'd be mine." Then came the phone records again. Same number, same store, same day. This time, the store manager testified that the woman who bought the bullets was young, blonde, and quiet. Not enough to confirm it was Carolyn, but close enough to cause suspicion. The defense pushed back hard. They accused the prosecution of manufacturing a villain. They brought in a psychologist who described Carolyn as emotionally manipulated, groomed by Paul into believing in a future that never existed. They argued that her behavior, while inappropriate, was never violent. And they drilled into the lack of direct evidence. No fingerprints, no eyewitnesses, no gun. But the prosecution countered with the glove. The state's forensic analyst explained in painstaking detail how the leather glove's lining held trace hemoglobin consistent with Betty Jean's blood type. The material was consistent with similar gloves sold in upscale boutiques across Westchester County. And while Carolyn's fingerprints weren't inside, neither were anyone else's. She didn't leave prints because she was careful, the analyst concluded. She left a glove because no killer is perfect. In court, Carolyn barely flinched. She sat still, composed, her hair neatly pinned back, her navy dress simple and conservative. But her eyes, those who watched closely said they flickered. Not with guilt, but with something harder to read. Maybe resolve, maybe resentment. Her attorney, Brannigan, tried one final tactic, to call Paul Solomon's character into question. He argued that Paul had manipulated two women at once, that he benefited the most from Betty Jean's death, that his testimony was self-serving, and that he was granted immunity from prosecution in exchange for a narrative that buried Carolyn. The judge shut it down. Relevance was questioned. Objection sustained. In his closing argument, Brannigan stood before the jury and said, "The state has given you a story, not a truth. No murder weapon, no eyewitness." And their most compelling piece of evidence was found months later in a dusty trunk, after their first attempt to convict her failed. He paused. "She's not perfect. But she's not a murderer." The prosecution closed with something very different. They projected a photo of Betty John, laughing beside her daughter at a school picnic. Then they showed the photo of her body on the living room floor. "This is not about jealousy. This is about a choice. A calculated, deliberate, irreversible choice. And justice demands a consequence." The jury took 3 days. On the fourth, they filed in, stone-faced. Carolyn didn't blink. She stared straight ahead. Guilty. Second-degree murder. The courtroom let out a collective exhale. Some cried, others muttered. Carolyn remained motionless. When the judge asked if she had anything to say before sentencing, she stood. "I did not kill Betty Jean Solomon," she said calmly. "I loved Paul. That was my mistake. But I did not take her life. That's not who I am." She was sentenced to 25 years to life. As she was led away in handcuffs, the media swarmed outside. Headlines were already being typed. "The Fatal Attraction Killer Sentenced." "Love Triangle Ends in Life Sentence." "Blonde, Beautiful, and Deadly." But behind all the drama, all the labels, one truth still whispered in the minds of those who followed the case closely. If Carolyn didn't do it, then who did? Chapter 4. Life Behind Bars. The moment the metal door clanked shut behind her, Carolyn felt her world shrink. The courtroom drama was over. The media frenzy faded. The story that had consumed New York tabloids, schoolteacher murders lover's wife, was replaced by the next scandal. But for Carolyn Warman, the real sentence had just begun. Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women wasn't built for comfort. Concrete, steel, and surveillance replaced her plush suburban apartment and designer handbags. Her day now started at 6 a.m. with a sharp buzz and ended with strip searches and body counts. She was no longer Ms. Warman. Inmate, River 89W324. Her first night in general population was quiet, but not peaceful. Whispers followed her. The new girl. The fatal attraction lady. Some inmates were fascinated by her. Others despised her. A few wanted her as a pet project, another blonde with a famous face who fell from grace. Within days, Carolyn learned the rules. Don't talk too much. Don't cry too loud. And never, ever act like you're better than anyone else. But she couldn't stop watching the door. Every time a new guard rotated in, every time a letter was slid under her cell door, every time someone mentioned Paul Solomon's name, because Carolyn hadn't stopped believing she'd been framed. She carried the conviction like a second skin, itching, burning, impossible to remove. She replayed the trial over and over in her mind. The glove, the bullet receipt, the diary entry twisted out of context. But most of all, Paul, his immunity, his cold, rehearsed voice on the stand. "He killed her," she told her cellmate one night in a whisper. "Or he knows who did. I was just the easiest story." Her cellmate, a tough Staten Island woman doing 18 years for armed robbery, shrugged. "Ain't no one in here innocent. But you, you're more believable than most." Still, Carolyn didn't crumble. She adapted. Slowly, she taught English to other inmates, led a poetry class, joined a vocational program for bookkeeping. Her hair lost its blonde sheen. Her nails were short and unpainted. But her mind, sharp as ever. Years passed. The press forgot her. The world moved on. And then, the letters started. Journalists, former students, even strangers. All writing to ask one thing. Did she...